You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 21st, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the show today, the executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayen, and the senators negotiating Biden's legacy. Meanwhile, Biden pumping out executive orders beginning to unravel the Trump era. The new administration reveals that they have now found no vaccine plan that was even developed by Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Biden enhances LGBTQ protections. And the Biden administration immediately fires some of the most egregious Trump appointees. Democrats rebuff Mitch McConnell, keep the door open to nuking the filibuster. Meanwhile, Romney and Murkowski want to tap the brakes on COVID relief. With over 4,000 COVID deaths yesterday, states are complaining they don't have enough vaccine doses. And the sad story of QAnon believers who are struggling to accept that Biden's inauguration actually happened. Lastly, Chicago teachers vote to authorize a walkout beginning of next week. And Democrats await the articles of impeachment in the Senate while Donald Trump trying to find some lawyers. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. With me, as always, Emma Viglin. Emma, hello. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You know, I just learned some disturbing news that the MyPillow guy dated Jenna from 30 Rock, Jane Krakowski. This is what is bothering me on this Thursday morning, afternoon at this point.
That sounds pretty disturbing.
She never slept better in her life.
It sounds like something Jenna would do, maybe not the actress, but.
Wow, that's pretty crazy. Well, I guess, the have pillow will travel. It is the first day of the Biden administration, or the another way to look at it that I think a lot of people are looking at it this way. It's the first day without Donald Trump as president. And I have to admit, I think we've talked about yesterday on the program. We're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about for the days forward. There's a very different feel with this incoming Democratic president than Barack Obama in some respects. I think Biden has learned the lessons of the early days of the Obama administration to some extent. And I think progressives have certainly learned the lesson from the early days of the Obama administration, including the transition in terms of how much space they're going to give Joe Biden. I don't think it's going to be as much as was given Barack Obama. And of course, we also have a raging pandemic. And the Biden transition, this comes up, we'll talk to David Dayen about this. The transition team apparently has the ability now to sort of basically spill the beans and say, when we met with the Trump people, they had no plan whatsoever for vaccination distribution. And it's quite obvious. I mean, I think around the country, certainly we're feeling it in New York. New York got a smaller amount of doses this week than they did the week before. Bill de Blasio had to announce the closing of more than a half a dozen vaccination sites because there's simply no vaccine.
It's almost as if the Trump team, just once they knew they weren't going to remain, didn't care about putting any infrastructure in place to ensure vaccinations throughout the country.
I mean, that's, I think, even a charitable look at it, because they should have been putting that into place in August. I mean, we knew at one point there was going to be a vaccine. Maybe they didn't know it was going to be in November. Maybe they thought it was going to be in February or March or April of this year. But you're going to need that infrastructure to produce it, and better earlier than later. At least come up with a plan. Nothing. Nothing.
Well, that's a little bit tough for the Trump team, but, you know, thinking ahead, being strategic,
well,
doing
I
politics,
think,
do, I mean, doing governing. Is
this
really
is a failure, and it's a Republican failure, frankly. Yeah. And, you know, there is a disdain for government by the Republicans, and it shows when they are tasked to operate the levers of a functioning government. But let's turn our attention for a moment to the most of unreasonable expectations of Joe Biden. And it's not even that it's the expectation is unreasonable, although it is. It's also that when you are faced with 400,000 Americans dead, when you are faced yesterday on Inauguration Day, over 4,000 Americans died of COVID. When you are faced with, we had again, over 900,000 new unemployment claims announced today. Every week that has passed since the beginning of this epidemic, the number of jobless claims has been higher than at any other period in our history, starting in 1967, where they started to measure these unemployment claims at that time. So through the Great Recession, we are a country in deep, deep material crisis. There's an epidemic. People are dying. People are losing their jobs. People can't pay for food. We have massive food lines. And one of the sort of, I guess, slight criticisms we had, although this is an important function for the president, I can understand that, about yesterday, was that there was a lot of soaring rhetoric, a lot of metaphor. I don't want to say pablum, but there was stuff in there that was really just to make us feel good and it feel some type of sense that our democracy is safe. I think that's a legitimate function.
Patriotism of politics of like 30, 40 years ago.
But I think, you know, I think there's a certain role for the president to play. But the press should be better, and they're not. Here is CNN. Here's Jim Sciutto. This is a CNN anchor calling out to the president. This is really the least relevant question as to what Joe Biden needs to get done with all of those challenges that I just enumerated.
Mr. President, can you unite the country? It's quite a moment, Jay, because this is something we did not know we would see today, given the security.
You know, if I had a moment to ask Joe Biden, the incoming president, something, might not be that, especially because that's the only thing Joe Biden talks about. I mean, not the only thing, but his number one talking point, number one piece of rhetoric is unity, unity. I'm going to unite. I'm not going to divide. Unity, unity. Not really at the top of my mind. Not a burning question. Are you focused on unity, Joe Biden? Pretty sure he is.
Well, and the funny thing is that, you know, it's one thing for Joe Biden to call for unity of the American people, but the idea that Joe Biden can unite people, this just came out in the Washington Post today. Over 70% of Republicans said they agreed with President Trump's contention. This is a study that was done with 2,600 registered voters. It was done about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Over 70% of Republicans said they agreed with President Trump's contention that he received more votes than Joe Biden. And this is across the board with Republicans. It's not, you know, a non-college educated Republican. It was across the board with Republicans. They gave them three statements, all false. One, millions of fraudulent mail-in and absentee ballots were cast in this past election. Two, voting machines were manipulated to add tens of thousands of votes for Joe Biden. And three, thousands of votes were recorded for dead people. Those were the statements they gave. And more than 50% of Republican respondents said it was very accurate those three false statements, 50% over 50% said they were very accurate statements. Over 75% of Republicans either said they were very accurate statements or somewhat accurate statements. There is no unifying the country. I don't even know what that means, in the sense that is everybody going to be on the same page? The answer is no. However, the one thing that I think, if you were to ask them is it a bad thing to have 400,000 people dead? Is it a bad thing to have 4,000 people dying on that day of COVID? Is it a bad thing to have millions of Americans unemployed? Millions of Americans in food lines? I think the answer is probably yes. And then I think the real question that the press should be asking, the media should be asking, is what are you going to do to fix that? Period. End of story. However,
I mean, the question, just quickly, the question should be, how are you going to unify exactly. the country? How are you going to do it? I mean, my view is you increase people's material well-being because people are really hurting right now. But that doesn't need to be CNN's question there. It shouldn't be, are you going to unite the country? I mean, Biden could just go, yeah. All right. End of story. End of question.
And to be fair, it's not just CNN that's obsessed with that question. Here's Ainsley Earhart on Fox News, and she feels that it's going to be very disunifying if Joe Biden does anything as president.
So our country's got to come together. And Joe Biden said yesterday, I want unity. He talked about that in his speech. But the first thing he does, the first order of business, is to walk in, sit down at the table, and he has 17 executive orders, really wiping away much of what President Trump did. So his supporters are saying, how can we have unity if you're taking away everything that we like?
Pause it for one second. The first one that they put up there is that you've got to wear a mask in federal buildings.
Yeah.
How tyrannical.
That critique would be in a bit of better faith if Trump hadn't just barged into the White House 4 years later and ripped up everything that had Obama's scent on it or anything Obama touched, tried to set it on fire. Ridiculous.
Continue to play with we're gonna play that clip.
You're taking away everything that we like.
You have those scrolling across your COVID screen right now, those 17 executives orders. There's too many to list off, but we can just highlight a few. Ending President Trump's 1776 commission, rejoining the World Health Organization. Of course, there was a lot of criticism for who
Keystone is the one they're mad at.
Of COVID across this world, rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, and many, many more. Speaking of the Paris Climate Agreement, there is, of course, this push to rejoin the world's effort to battle climate change. Joe Biden is making it one of the first things he wants to do in his administration. Well, Mark Moreno, he's executive editor of ClimateDepot.com.
Okay, we don't need to see any more of that. It's
like a highlight reel.
Yeah, I know. And I like how what they extend the eviction moratorium until September. That was one of the things on that scroll.
Disunifying.
Trump's policy. That was Trump's policy, but it's disunifying for him to extend it. It's disunifying for me, or it's irritating to me that he's not going further than that. And still has not made an effort quite yet to cancel any cent of student debt. So that's
all right. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect, on all of these executive orders and much more. We'll be right back after this. Folks, today's sponsor of the Majority Report is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. I think people are aware of this, but a lot of therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. It can take weeks. It can take months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs. And they do so within 24 hours. You'll be talking to them. Stressful time. Folks have anxiety. I myself am, feeling it. I'd imagine others are. I think in some ways, my feeling about the Trump era is sort of like when you're, holding off for vacation and all of a sudden you get a cold, like all of a sudden I've found the just the end of the Trump era to be sort of a rush of things that I feel like I was not dealing with.
That you were directing towards the Trump
Honestly, I have that feeling. But BetterHelp is a great way. If you've never done therapy, this is a great way to start it. And if you have done therapy, but you don't have a therapist at the moment, this is also a great way because, A, you find a therapist almost immediately. And if you don't think it's a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason for no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists all over the country. They have therapists with specialties that may not be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than the therapist you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to have BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/majority report. You can find the link in our YouTube description and in our podcast description. Also, this one always makes me blush a little bit, but I'm sorry, folks. I'm not gonna lie. I'm enjoying it. It's a creature comfort. New year, new rear, new year, 2021. Don't just make a commitment to wash your hands every time you you go to the loo, as it were. Go the extra mile and wash your butt. The brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment is finally here. It's stylish, it's eco-friendly, it's easy to install, and it's affordable. Now, I have the old version, but they just sent me a new one. I'm going to try that out, and it's super easy to install. All you need to do is be able to like unscrew the it's literally, you can do it with any type of like wrench. You don't need any real tools or anything. It's super easy. You don't need any more plumbing. You don't need any additional electricity. It cuts toilet paper use by 80%. So if we ever get into one of those situations again, folks, where, you know, people are mad rush for toilet paper, you don't worry about it. It doesn't just cleanse your butt with a precise stream of water, this 3.0 one. It cleans itself before and after it's used with the Smart Spray automatic self-cleaning nozzle. Sanitation is simple. Smush Sealed offers easy cleaning. The knobs are naturally antimicrobial. I can't say that word. Plus, every Hello Tushy bidet attachment comes with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. If you don't like it, you take it off your toilet, you send it back. Upgrade to the new 3.0 model if you're already hooked on Hello Tushy, or if you're new to the revolution, join millions of happy customers right now. Have a clean butt with every flush. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority. You get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners. Go to HelloTushy, TUSHY.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. Also, folks, just a reminder, Nomiki is doing her show at 3 p.m. every day, Tuesday through Friday. You can check out her show today, youtube.com/TheNomiki Show, or on Twitch, which is the_Nomiki_show on Twitch. And today's guest, Harvey K. Representative Rob and Arun Chaudhry will be on with Nomiki. Check that out. Also, as always, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. You get the free show, commercial free, and you get extra content every day. Okay, now on with the show. We are back. Joining us now is the executive editor of The American Prospect. And I got us to start off, David Dayan. And let me just first start off, David. Of course, I've been interviewing you for an extended period of time. But I got to tell you, the reporting that you guys have done over The American Prospect in terms of leading up to the Biden inauguration, in terms of who they were going to pick for some key spots, was amazing. You guys outreported some of the biggest newspapers and reporting and media enterprises in the country. So kudos on that. And you also at The American Prospect have been writing about Joe Biden's day one agenda for months, if not a year, I think, or certainly by the time he got the nomination. And it was, and I think when you started, it was not Joe Biden's day one agenda. It was whoever the president was. Well, we are now in day two of the Biden administration. I want to get into what's happening in the Senate and in terms of the COVID relief, but give us a sense of what Joe Biden did yesterday and today. And of course, on some level, it's a metaphor, right? What he's done so far relative to A, what he can do, and B, what he projected he would do.
Right. I mean, the day one agenda is just sort of a stand-in for executive action. And, you know, we outlined starting September 2019, what the executive actions could be that the next Democratic president could take. So here comes Biden on day one. And the vast majority of what he did was reversing Trump actions. Some of those very laudable reversals, ending construction of the border wall, ending the migrant protection program, a lot of really cruel immigration programs, rejoining the Paris Agreement, and so on. Getting back to the status quo of 2016, I mean, in a sense, that's great. It's also, not exactly an expansive vision for executive action. It just sort of puts us back to where we were. And, presidents often do this. They reverse, they do the easy work of reversing the actions of their predecessor. There's a thing called the Mexico City rule, which is around abortion law. And I think it's been added and subtracted in every administration since, I think, Clinton. And on day one, first you put it up and then you bring it down, and then you put it up, bring it down. So this is kind of normal. The one thing that was actually in our day one agenda package that Biden actually enacted on day one was this thing, very obscure thing called the social cost of carbon. And let me explain it. We had a guy, Steve Novick, that wrote a piece for us about it. When you do regulation, you have to do this cost benefit analysis of whether it's worth it to do the regulation. And you take into account on the cost side, not just the cost to businesses or things like that, but in terms of climate regulation, you take into account the social cost of putting carbon into the atmosphere. So what it means for communities, what it means for public health, what it means for all of these things. And they actually quantify this and they put it into a number. And under Trump and even before that, under Obama, this number was absurdly low. So it made it not worth it to engage in climate regulation because the social cost was very, very low. So Biden on day one said, we're going to restart the interagency working group and within 30 days come up with an interim recalculation of the social cost of carbon to make it better reflect what the actual impact of carbon pollution is. That's really great. It's like under the radar, really into the weeds. Right. But it's one of those things that we looked at in the day one agenda that is, maybe unheralded, but really, really important in terms of tangible kind of results. So that was good. But I think overall, you get kind of an incomplete here. You're reversing a bunch of Trump actions. That's great. But we need to go further and, hopefully when people get into place, we'll start to see that.
Well, David, the most glaring thing that's missing for me when I'm looking over his immediate agenda is cancellation of any student loan debt. Can you talk about what you've heard on that front when it comes to any executive action? The bar keeps getting lower and lower in terms of the financial threshold, but he's extending the canceling of interest rates through September, or the 0% interest rate. But yeah. Obviously there needs to be more action on that front.
Well, this is kind of what's amazing is that the authority that Biden is using, or Biden's education secretary is using, to pause payments and to cancel interest is the same authority that you would use to cancel student debt. So he's not denying that the ability is there, that the authority is inherent. He's just not going as far as needs to be gone. And of course, you know, pausing the payments is just extending what the Trump administration had put in place as far as student debt. I know that the administration is aware of the ability to cancel student debt. I know that there are champions within the government for doing it. At what level is unclear. Biden during the campaign said he was going to present to Congress his plan to cancel $10,000, the first $10,000. We thought was going to be in this $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, and it wasn't. That didn't even make the first cut. So it's unclear where we are with that. But I mean, I know that there is at least some sense within the administration that this is something they can do and that they should do. The question is whether they will win that argument.
That's a great question, Emma, because I want to make it clear. You know, I imagine there's a lot of people out there. I mean, look. There's a lot of people in this country who are very glad to see Donald Trump gone, and more reasons than we could outline probably in the context of at least one show. We would probably need hours for reasons for wanting Donald Trump gone. And there's a general sentiment of like, it's day one, you know, give him a chance to catch his breath and get some people in there. But I think the student loan issue, whether you agree with cancellation of debt or not, and I think, I mean, I certainly think that we should be doing that amount that Schumer and Warren called for, which was $50,000. But the point is that Joe Biden clearly knows he could do it. I just want to make it clear that this is a choice he's making in this moment. The effort that it took to extend that moratorium is exactly the same. The exact same effort. You just need to use your signature and sign it, and that could have happened. It was really just a question of will and choice, and so that's why these things. That's I think a perfect example of why it's fair to talk about this on day two as to absolutely. What happened on day one.
One thing about that, Sam, is that on their way out the door, the Education Department, Betsy DeVos's Education Department, put out this memo that tried to make a legal case for why the Education Department cannot cancel student debt. And the person who did it, the counsel, the lawyer who wrote this memo, previously worked at the Chamber of Commerce. And there are about 15 legal citations in the memo, and almost all of them are from opinions joined by or written by Antonin Scalia. So it was an extremely partisan effort on the part of the Education Department, just kind of build something that conservatives can then go back to and say, hey, the Education Department said that you can't do this. It was based on, you know, a lot of half readings of statutes and things like that. And it was all Scalia based, which was kind of amazing to me.
Yes, his long tentacles. And all right, well, there's a bunch of other things I want to talk about. And obviously we'll get to the COVID vaccine because that is, I mean, I think there's enormous mandate for him to do something about that. Maybe we should start there. In fact, it's being reported today. Now that the Biden transition team feels unshackled in terms of what they can talk about, what they found when they started to work with the Trump administration on the transition, Now that they're not worried about upsetting the feelings of the Republicans who worked for Trump, they're saying there was no plan, none whatsoever in terms of a vaccine. So Joe Biden has signaled, if not actually begun, the process of essentially launching the Defense Production Act. What areas is he going to use this? I mean, it seems to me from what I'm reading, among everything else, including the type of syringes so that you can actually get five doses out of the Pfizer, there seems to be a lack of vaccine. And it seems to me that like producing the vaccine is the greatest need right now.
Well, yeah, it's a real concern. We have a great piece today, actually, by Olivia Webb. It's a feature for our next issue about the difference between vaccine production and vaccine distribution. In vaccine production, the government really got involved, this whole Operation Warp Speed thing. They funded the vaccine effort. They gave government like purchase guarantees. They cleared up things in the supply chain. They really used their contracting power to accelerate this vaccine production, which, you know, normally takes years, and we got it done in 9 months. And then they took a completely laissez-faire approach to the distribution part of it. And you see how it's starting to struggle and wane from there.
Can I just clarify distribution and production? By production, are you talking about the development?
I'm talking about the development of the vaccine. Yes. And then by distribution, I'm talking about getting the vaccine into people's arms.
But so in between there, you also need to produce more.
And, you know, there was a lot of production that was sort of pre-positioned, but certainly not enough. And one thing we're seeing, particularly on the Moderna side, is that their promises for 100 million shots by the end of March seem to be now unrealistic. They would need to produce 1 million shots per day in order to get to that point, just as a production matter. And they're producing about 300,000 per day. So this is a real problem. And, you know, if you look at this, I mean, the Defense Production Act is what? It's a Korean War era law that was about scaling up to a war mobilization effort. And if you look at this as a war, which really it is in terms of, you know, the level of response that we need, that should be going into using whatever resources we have available. And frankly, it should have been months ago, because you got to retool a plant in order to, you know, get it ready for vaccine production. You got to retool a plant to make sure it can work. So this should have been in place a long, long time ago, but we should be doing whatever possible. So that means the syringes, the supplies, and things like that. It also means ingredients that go into the vaccine, because there are a lot of different things that have to go into creating and producing the vaccine, and then retooling the factories to do the vaccine itself. Now, one thing that you could do that Biden hasn't done yet is say, okay, Johnson & Johnson, Novavax, all these other companies that were trying to create the first vaccine, those plants are, you know, the ones that could most easily be converted to the vaccine that we know works and that we have emergency use authorization for. Those, you could go to those companies and say, I have the Defense Production Act. I am demanding that you convert your plant into making the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine, and Pfizer and Moderna are going to give you the ingredients so that you can, you are able to do that. So that's one thing that can be done.
And of course, I would imagine there would be pushback from the Johnson & Johnson, because we get more profit if we sell our own, et cetera, et cetera. I mean,
right. But they're compelled under the Defense Production Act, and they're paid for this.
Right. There is a fair market profit that's given to them. It's just it may not be the unfair market profit that they
the number one maximization of shareholder value may not be completely squeezed out, right? But
you know, I mean, the thing about the syringes is real. Like it, yeah. The difference between getting 5 doses out of a Pfizer vial and 6 is, you know, close to 20%. And you don't have to retool anything to do that. You just have to get the syringes with what they call low dead space, which means that you just don't waste as much per shot. And so, you know, what we don't know is some of the syringes that are being shipped by the government to these various vaccine locations, some of them have the low dead space syringes and some of them don't. And we don't know how many do and how many don't. So we can't really assess, you know, what the benefit in total would be from redoing the whole syringe supply chain and making sure we're maximizing.
I feel like there could be an entire industry built upon just the absolute failure of the Trump Republican administration on just doing this. I mean, this seems so fundamental, so rudimentary that honestly, I feel like a teenager, with all due respect to teenagers, could have basically outlined everything that needs to be done for the moment we're in now. I mean,
what you're talking about when you're doing it is war mobilization, and it means money, right? And every dollar we spend, you know, sometimes we talk about like the multiplier effect.
Right.
So like a dollar of infrastructure gets you $1.50 of economic activity. A dollar of vaccine spending probably gets you $10 of, I've seen reports, a conservative estimate that every one day that we get closer to normalcy, in other words, every one day we get closer to herd immunity and we can reopen the country, means like $10 billion in economic activity. It's an insane number. And so, you know, that argues for let's do a bill that appropriates a massive amount of money for vaccines right now. Let's not wait for a reconciliation process that could take months and months and months and be elongated. Let's do that right now. And on the assumption that you would have bipartisan support to get the country back to normal. And if you don't, you can tag Republicans with that. Like they want people to die and they want the economy to be crippled.
And then pass the $2,000 checks and UI that. Through reconciliation.
Yes.
Right.
That's- I wrote this today at First 100, our new story, a series on the first 100 days. It's the checks and shots strategy. So you bundle together the $2,000 checks and money for vaccines, and that bill, in theory, can pass with 60 votes under regular order really fast. Okay. And that sounds like a skinny bill, but if you think about it, it's about $430 billion to top up these checks to $2,000. And if you make them just $2,000 checks, it's about $600 billion. And the money that Biden has asked for the vaccine, if you're including the Public Health Jobs Corps of 100,000 workers, if you're including money for testing, that's another $400 billion. This is almost the size of the December bill, the $900 billion bill. Right. It's not skinny. It's like it's a big bill and it probably can pass. So let's do it.
All right. Well, let's talk about what's happening in the Senate, because there's I'm seeing reporting that there's a sort of like multiple tracks that are happening. And we'll talk a little bit about one thing that came out in the reporting in the past day or two is that Chuck Schumer has rebuffed Mitch McConnell's desire to basically commit to shelving the idea of filibuster reform as part of their 50-50 power sharing. And I think the power sharing is probably an overstatement in terms of what it actually means in practice, in the way that they organize the Senate. Let's go to that in a moment. But my understanding is that the Biden administration and the Biden transition team had already begun negotiations with a gang of 16, they're calling it, which is 8 Democrats, 8 Republicans, who are presumably sort of the least conservative in the Republican Party and the most conservative in the Democratic Party, I think is probably the way to say it, ostensibly. And they're meeting supposedly to hammer out this deal. I just saw a report that said Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski are saying that the timing seems a little bit like the ink's not dry on that $900 billion.
Right.
Do you have a sense of what the state of play in those negotiations are and what the strategy is by the Biden administration in the way that they're approaching this? I mean, because it could be a myriad, that right? It could be they're looking for that so-called skinny bill, which is really not that skinny, or they're looking for the Republicans to reject the whole thing so they can justify filibuster reform, or they're thinking reconciliation. Give us a sense of what you've heard in terms of what's going on with this.
Well, look, if you read the public statements of Murkowski and Romney, it's pretty clear that you're not going to get Republican support for the bill that Biden put out.
That's the $1.9 trillion bill.
Correct. I mean, you're not going to get Republican support for it. You're just not. And, you know, I think that has triggered this idea of a skinny bill strategy, of a checks and shots strategy, because that might get 60 votes. And you could at least try that. And if it works, you get that done and you put points on the board. You build trust because this is what you ran on in Georgia. And you get the money out fast, which you need to do on vaccines. And it would be good to do on checks. Already the $600 bills, you're seeing raise sales in restaurants, for example. That was something that came out in the Wall Street Journal today. So, you know, that's the idea, is that you do that skinny bill and then you go back and you can, under reconciliation rules, do the rest of the bill where you don't have to rely on Republican support. I think they're going to inevitably get to that idea. The question is when. I mean,
right.
And do we have to wait around when Mitt Romney and Lisa Murkowski, who are your most likely votes, or at least Murkowski is, are saying, I don't want to do this? I mean, take no for an answer and move on.
Well, what's your sense of what their timing's going to be? I mean, it sort of feels like we're watching a movie that we have watched a million times before during the Obama administration. And it's, you know what? We know how this ends.
Right.
Barack Obama, I think, wrote about it in his book on how it ends. Like, why do we have to stay to the end?
Right. what I have heard from the people I've talked to is that there is an understanding that there's kind of a deadline here. And that deadline is when the unemployment extension runs out again. And that is the middle of March. So they recognize that they're going to have to get something in place before then. Because what we're seeing now is the fact that we waited so long until those programs actually expired for Donald Trump to finally sign the bill in December. That has still, 3 weeks later, led to millions of people who are not back up on those programs. I mean, it's just hard to turn around these very rickety state unemployment systems. And so there's an understanding that, yeah, we got to get that in place pretty soon, because there's a lag time here and we don't want to go to the end again. And usually Congress doesn't get its act together until there's a deadline anyway. The question is, it's January 21st. Why do we have to wait until March 14th when these things expire, or to even the end of February? Let's get the reconciliation bill in motion. If we want to do checks and shots, let's do that. Let's get moving. But apparently the House is out next week. So we're already pushing this thing.
Let's talk just one more thing in terms of legislation, then one or two others. I know you're a little bit beginning to get pressed for time here, but the H1S1. H.R. 1, these H.R. 1 was passed by the House in 2018. It is a sort of an omnibus bill, including all sorts of voting rights and anti-corruption measures. The Senate is, I think, going to look at the same thing. Do you have a sense of how, of what the interplay, like, and I think we saw an announcement the other day, or at least some reporting that the Democrats are saying that the, you know, that, that reconciliation bill may not come until the beginning of March, at least the big one. Maybe they do the skinny one in between there. Do you get a sense that there is some type of coordinated strategy of, if Mitt Romney says no to this, then the filibuster, then reconciliation? Is there any sequencing? Is there any, do you get the sense that they are gaming this out, or is it one of those things like, well, let's just see what happens and we'll decide in the moment?
I don't think there's a lot of strategy there. What I would say is that it does appear clear that the people who matter on the filibuster issue, people like Joe Manchin, people like Kyrsten Sinema, John Hickenlooper, maybe, they need to be shown. I don't know why, but they need to be shown one more time that Republicans are going to obstruct any effort at progress. They need to be shown again. And so S1 is doomed. Like there's not going to be any Republican support for S1, for democracy reform. You have the folks down in Georgia right now at the state level saying, well, we really have to change these voting procedures, or else, you know, Republicans are never going to be able to win here. I mean, that's like almost a direct quote from a state legislator in Georgia.
It is a direct quote, far as I can tell. Yes.
So, you know, you're just not going to get buy-in for, you know, the kinds of things that are in H.R. 1 and S1. And so it's a choice. And I've seen Ezra Klein posit this, like, it's a choice that you can make. We can either have democracy reform, or we can have the filibuster. By the same token, we can either have minimum wage, although maybe there are ways to finesse that in a reconciliation bill. But really, we can either have an increase in the minimum wage, or we can have the filibuster. So, you know, the choice is up to those individuals that are, you know, standing in the way. And, you know, the problem is we don't have a good whip count on that. I mean, we know Manchin's probably against it. We know that Sinema might be. Dianne Feinstein might be against doing the filibuster. I mean, we don't know, and we should know. I mean, that should be an effort from the grassroots to try to find out where people are on filibuster reform, so we know how far we are away. I mean,
that's a good point. I don't know if people remember this, but back in 2005, in George Bush's second term, at the beginning of second term, he wanted to privatize Social Security. I think it was Talking Points memo that started a essentially a grassroots whip count, where it was contact your congressperson, ask them where they stand on this. And it created pressure against those who were for privatizing Social Security. And I should just add, just so that people understand, when you talk about H1 and S1, and when you talk about the $15 minimum wage, these are, and the $15 minimum wage is, there's a question about, but H1 and S1, because they deal with voting rights and like you say, democracy reforms, they don't affect the government's budget, and they cannot be included in the reconciliation process, which can only deal with legislation that fundamentally and non-incidentally affects the government budget.
But let me say one thing here, because I know you never miss an opportunity to praise Chuck Schumer. So I want to do that. You know, he has not agreed to this bid by McConnell to get him on the record on keeping the filibuster intact.
Yep.
He has held out and in a pretty impressive way, because, you know, I mean, McConnell's effort here might just be delay, because as long as you don't have an operating agreement, you can't get much done in the Senate, particularly on nominees, because it's you're not talking about how many members are of each party are going to be on the committees. I mean, that's what gets figured out in the power sharing agreement. And without that, it's hard to move forward. Although you can, obviously. I mean, Avril Haines was confirmed yesterday. But It's harder to set up the committees and move forward without that power sharing agreement. So McConnell might be just trying to delay. But good on Chuck Schumer for not saying, okay, yeah, I'll agree to that. I'll keep the filibuster intact.
Let me just also say there's a clock on that, because there is a somewhere in New York State, there is a filing deadline for primaries. And Chuck Schumer is very concerned, is my understanding, of being primaried. And so
is your paperwork filled out on that yet? Or
I am still I'm
filling it out for him, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah, exactly. Emma's working on the paperwork as we speak. But the point being that his incentive to pursue filibuster reform probably significantly diminishes if he feels like his seat is secure. And I don't think there's any question. I mean, I think he thinks that he can win a primary. I don't think there's any reason to doubt that. He has a tremendous amount of money. But it's not a good look for the Senate Majority Leader to lose 30% of the Democratic vote in New York State, or more for that matter, in a primary. And there's certainly some of that happening in New York. And so he has some pressure. And so it's going to be interesting to sort of, like, people should keep that in their mind. At one point, Chuck Schumer is going to make a determination as to how serious that primary threat is. And if he determines that it's not that serious, he may start acting in a slightly different manner. All right. Lastly, if you have a moment, like the two big stories is the Congressional Review Act and the firings. There were three major firings yesterday by the Biden administration, one of whom was the General Counsel of National Labor Relations Board, which apparently is a very big deal because this is a 5-member board. I mean, this is like, there's a lot of people, there's very few people making a determination. Or I should say
the GC, what the GC does, General Counsel, is it really prioritizes cases for the board, and it devotes resources in terms of staff attorneys.
He's the throttle, essentially.
He is the throttle. So it's an important position. And this guy, Peter Robb, is an anti-union guy going way back to, he was involved in the PATCO firing, the firing of the air traffic controllers under Reagan in the 80s. So this is like an OG anti-union guy.
Right.
So what was interesting about that is that Biden asked for the resignation of three people. It was the head of the CFPB, the head of the parent organization for Voice of America, and this guy Rob from the NLRB. And CFPB and Voice of America people, they just resigned. They said, okay, we will.
CFPB is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This is they in charge a lot of.
And by the way, if it wasn't for a Supreme Court ruling that said the president can fire the head of the CFPB, that person would have been in place until December 2023. So thank you, Supreme Court, for facilitating consumer protection in America. Anyway, those two resigned. But this Peter Robb guy said, I'm not resigning. I refuse to resign. And now think
I hate unions so much that I'm not going to let go of this job.
I need to stay. And he was eligible. He was eligible to stay until November. His term didn't run out until November. Think back to the Obama administration. If they were confronted with this, they would have taken a meeting. They would have maybe done a poll on how this would play on Fox News. And they would have just really deeply thought about this for a while. Within about 5 minutes of Peter Robb saying, I'm not quitting, he was fired. Whether it's learning from the past or whether it's just a different orientation on the part of the Biden administration, there was a definite sense that we're going to do this thing that we promised to do. And we're not going to worry about the optics of it. And we're not going to worry about whether it looks like, overweening, force against conservatives. We don't care. You're out.
All this is flooding back from those early days of the Obama administration, where there was a real concern about czars. that that the Obama administration was appointing. And lastly, the any executive action that is taken within a certain window to the end of the administration is subject to review by Congress, reversal, and then a higher threshold to reinstitute it in the future.
Yeah. And that also is done under a 50 vote environment. So for the Senate, that's not filibusterable. So you can do that with a majority vote. So I assume that somewhere, I mean, this was only a reality after Georgia. So it's a scramble, but I assume somewhere in the administration there or in Congress, they're coming up with lists of things to overturn because they need to get on that. The clock is ticking.
Sam's internet might have cut out right there. All right. Well, I think we're probably going to wrap up now. Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate your time. We both do. I'll speak for Frozen Sam there.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
We are back. Frozen Sam is alive. Thank you for handling that. We had a little bit of an internet issue there, but I got to say, you know, it is a very odd. I just the juxtaposition between the Obama administration and the Biden administration is a fascinating one, insofar as I believe the expectations and the excitement, frankly, around the Obama election and his presidency was greater than it is for Biden. And the level of scrutiny of his first executive orders and how he was setting up was much less. And yet, you know, Biden, because of the pressure that he is getting from Democrats who want to see him go big, we're starting to see a little bit more. Now, with that said, literally over the past hour, it has been announced that, or reported, I should say, that Mitch McConnell is holding up the resolution of that organizing the rules for the Senate, basically filibustering it, and holding it hostage for Chuck Schumer to say that he will not use filibuster reform. I mean, there's an interesting take here, and maybe this is something we'll talk about more tomorrow. When Joe Biden comes out and he talks about unity that much, it becomes a leverage point for Republicans to say, you're not delivering on the unity. And it makes it very easy for them to dictate the success or failure of Biden's agenda and dictate it so that it's on Joe Biden's shoulders, as opposed to if Joe Biden's primary agenda was, we're going to get, and of course he stated this, but unity obviously carried the day yesterday. We're going to have everybody inoculated. We're going to have everybody taken care of if you've lost your job. We're going to have everybody taken care of if you can't pay your rent, if you are food insecure, all of this. And
but making, you know, hard policy promises, that's just not Biden's style, and it never has been. He wants to talk like vaguely about unity and promising to make people's lives better, but not necessarily tied to any specific policy proposal or outcome.
I mean. He's listed them off, but he certainly hasn't put them as the primary sales pitch. I mean, you know, as evidenced at least by his inaugural speech. And it really, the next 30 days, maybe 60 days, but I'm thinking closer to 45, we're going to know whether Joe Biden is going to abandon that notion that he has the ability to unify people who, frankly, the Republican Party is still the Republican Party that they were before Donald Trump, who wouldn't give Merrick Garland a hearing, that they were during Donald Trump, and that they will be tomorrow. And the sooner that Joe Biden accepts that and decides that he's going to move his agenda forward, I think the better off the country is going to be, and frankly, the better off Joe Biden's going to be politically.
The better off the Democratic Party is going to be, not responding to this moment with a robust stimulus, which is needed. And in order to get that, you need to combat the Republicans. And also those $2,000 checks that Biden promised. Not doing so would be a political disaster for the Democratic Party. So just for self-preservation, they need to do it.
Well, stay tuned, folks. We'll be covering that tomorrow. And then the days and weeks ahead, we will see you then. And for those of you who are sticking around, the full crew is about to hop on the Zoom call, and I am about to drop off. I will tell you this, a little bit of house cleaning. I will be, I believe, doing, I think, a live stream or maybe a recording on, I'm not sure exactly, on the podcast Bad Faith. And so Bree and Virgil, Texas, we'll be talking to them. I presume some of it will be about, you know, the whole force the vote thing, and just based probably generally the perspective that that we need to take when dealing with Democrats to get what we want from Democrats. And so tune into that. I think I'll have more information about that probably tomorrow. But if you want to support this program, join themajorityreport.com. When you do, you become a member of the program, you support the free show, and then you get extra content and you get the free show without commercials. Also, check out AM Quickie. You can sign up for that at amquickie.com. Today, I mentioned on Nomi's show, you can find it at youtube.com/TheNomiki Show or twitch.tv/Nomiki_show. And who I can't remember exactly who she had was having on today. Today she's having, Harvey K is going to be on. So check that out. And they had a great show yesterday. I think Stephanie Kelton was on, maybe Thomas Frank as well. So check that out. In the meantime, Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, it's a very special episode in honor of Martin Luther King Day and of the inauguration of our new president. I was joined by Aaron Thorpe of the Trillbilly Workers Party and A Time of Monsters, as well as Andre Domiz of the Drop Squad, to talk about the first volume of Barack Obama's serial killer memoir, A Promised Land. So we talk all about it, what he's trying to do, how he brought Americans together. Is he more like Lena Dunham or Walter White? It's a really good primer, considering that we're going in for round two right now of kind of an Obama-like administration. So that's out now, patreon.com/TheAntifada. Do I feel bad for making a couple of black leftists talk about Obama on MLK Day? Yes. Yes, I do. Are we going to do it again when the second volume comes out? Probably.
Is there going to be a second volume?
Oh, there's going to be at least two. Because he couldn't say what he wanted to say in one 700-page book.
Damn. Well, I've actually been thinking about reading that.
I might audiobook it.
You can borrow my copy. It's got a lot of notes in it already.
Does it just drip smugness?
Sounds pretty good too. Maybe at half speed or three times speed rather.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very smug. He hates us. That's the most clear part. He hates everyone except for like Larry Summers and Timothy Geithner and people like that. He loves them.
They're good guys. I've told that story about what Elliot Spitzer once told me. I'll save it for now. Matt.
What?
Oh, I got a story about Elliot Spitzer's perspective on Obama back in like 2010.
When dazzled he was making, by Ivy Leaguers, basically.
Yeah, basically it was just sort of, he didn't understand.
Although, didn't like, understand I've how, thought about that. Like, he didn't understand, like, that those guys were idiots, right? But his mom was also an academic. Like, he shouldn't have been completely clueless.
Both of his parents were.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, it's
it wasn't so much that he didn't understand that they were stupid as much as they didn't. He assumed that because they had they were, you know, at a certain, you know, of a certain class or station, that they knew what they were talking about. I mean, that's
well,
a problem.
It's
that
a
I think
conflation of like intelligence with virtuousness or with, you know, the right way to govern.
I think he just felt like these people knew what they were talking about. I mean, and I don't think he just thought that at that moment. I think he thought that, I think he must have thought that throughout his sort of like, even at Harvard Law School. I think this is a longer conversation, but maybe I should read the book first. And then
here's the thing we figured out first.
Yeah.
Like anywhere in the book where you're like, wow, I thought Obama was supposed to be the smart president. Why is he being so dumb about this? No, he's not dumb. He thinks that you're dumb. And he's talking to you like you're a child. So that might be what was going on with that perception of his being impressed by Harvard Law people or whatever.
It doesn't age well, his like whole attitude about governance, for sure.
It wasn't so great at the beginning either,
no,
to be honest.
I know. I just mean it gets worse and worse with time.
Yes.
Like
Matt Binder, what's happening on Doomed?
Well, hello, Sam. Last night on a special inauguration episode of Doomed, I had Jared Holt, the right-wing researcher and host of another right-wing podcast on the show. And we basically talked about the QAnon freakout on inauguration day and where the movement goes from there and what other right-wing movements are going to try to sort of bring the QAnon people into their further right, even more nefarious, reactionary worlds.
Were you surprised that there was no violence at any of the state capitals around the country? I mean, obviously you have 15,000 troops, maybe more, in Washington, D.C. I don't think there was much room there. And I think some of the capitals were definitely locked down, like around Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. But were you surprised that there weren't any anywhere?
No, I mean, at that point, what were they going to do? Like January 6th was their last stand to take action and actually do something with Trump still in office. At that point, on the 20th, Trump left earlier that day. He already basically conceded that day and said, I'm out. What were they gonna do? You know, and also I think, you know, a lot of the QAnon people are probably, in the eyes of other more extremist right-wing groups, they're soft. You know, they sit online and they dream of these things happening, but they don't actually, for the most part, do anything. You know, even on on January 6th, the QAnon people, like, you know, they stood out because they were dressed in such flamboyant costumes, a lot of them. And you know, it's easy to point them out with their Q t-shirts, but they were probably the most identifiable. Like, what were they going to do in terms of get away with anything that they would pull off? The true, like, you know, people to worry about were the ones down there on January 6th in militia groups, in white supremacist groups, who actually had, you know, gone down
Biggs,
there and full-blown, yeah.
The like head of Proud Boys apparently was telling people, dress in black, so they think you're Antifa when you go to the Capitol. Matt right. Leck, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Tonight at 8 Eastern, the new time, allows people not on the East Coast to get off work and stuff. 8 Eastern, we've got Milton Alamadi on to talk about Uganda and Museveni and Bobby Wine, what's going on there with the basically self-coup. We'll also get Milton's reaction to Biden and the Capitol riots. And we'll also talk about how Bill Gates is buying up all the farmland. So that's tonight at 8 Eastern at Left Reckoning's YouTube channel, patreon.com/leftreckoning, to get the postgame.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. You'll see these guys in the fun half.
All
in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back, back, back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back. Back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Fuck you, reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Almost says what?
Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank. Hell out of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black.
You see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't not us.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back. Black, black.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy, total, 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 pussy.